Punchline.
We had a band and they're all like jazz heads, you know what I mean? Cool dudes. So we had to tell them, you guys ain't playing on this show. And I thought they were gonna be like, ah, oh, that's just gonna be milk toast. But I remember them all being like, oh shit, you're gonna see Schaefer.
Here it comes.
Here it comes.
You're listening to Fresh Era, a show about the legends from the golden era of hip hop. Each episode, we bring you stories from the pioneers themselves as we dive deep into their lives, their struggles, and what it was like to be a part of the most popular form of music before it was mainstream. I'm your host, Craig Smith. Now, one of my favorite things about art in any medium is the ability to create your own world. There's something about bringing the audience into this thing that you're creating. With the right tools, you can create a reality distortion field, and everyone that partakes can get lost in the art. Well, today, we bring you the story of someone who did just that. Butterfly of Diggable Planets isn't just a cool-ass MC. Turns out, the world of Diggable Planets had been his brainchild for years before they got a record deal. And even more surprising, the idea for Diggable Planets predated the members. So for this story, we have to go all the way to Seattle, Washington.
This is Ishmael Reginald Denon Butler, born July 3rd, 1969 in Seattle, Washington.
And going as far back as his grandparents, there existed this theme of exploration and hard work.
My grandmother and my grandfather being the sort of curious and daring frontiersmen that they were, they came up here sight unseen, you know what I mean, to forge out a new life for themselves and see what the opportunities brought.
Eventually, they landed in Seattle's Central District.
The sort of like up-and-coming Black neighborhood in the city where people could afford housing.
Central District had undergone significant changes in demographics from the early 1900s. By the 1960s, as race-restricted covenants excluded Black families from moving into certain neighborhoods, Black people from all over the country began to settle in Central District during the Second Great Migration.
The whole neighborhood was really vibrant with a lot of transplants from Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas. People came up here for job opportunities and shit like that. I just remember, like, playing in the yard, playing with all my neighbors. It'd be 12, 13 kids on the block, you know, all from varying ages, and people calling, you know, your mom, grandma calling you to come home, walking to and from school from the grade school days.
And at home, he was faced with some changes early on as his mother and father split up. But this would end up expanding his world.
They had an amicable relationship, so I was always in the East Coast, New York, where my father lived for a little bit, Philadelphia, where a lot of my family was, Baltimore, D.C., I lived there.
This bi-coastal living gave him a wide range of experiences that left their marks.
It was very distinct, what you would get in New York, even what you would get in Brooklyn, from what you would get in Harlem, and then that kind of stuff, North Philly, South Philly, West Philly, D.C., I was in all of those places.
And when he got to middle school, he started to live with his father permanently.
He was actually getting his doctorate degree in early American history, so he would have to, like, teach sometime at different places.
And this had him traveling up and down the East Coast with his father, soaking up all the culture that he could.
I had a good young life, very free, encouraged to explore, actually forced to explore sometime, you know?
And with that exploration, being on both coasts with his mother and father, he was also exposed to a spectrum of musical tastes.
So mom's was Motown at her core.
My mama told me you better shop around.
But then when she got older, she was more of Earth, Wind & Fire, Gil Scott-Heron.
But no one stopped to think about the people.
Uplifted people, revolutionary sounding music, Luther and stuff like that. Pop music, she was into that. My dad wasn't, it wasn't no pop music.
His dad took music pretty seriously.
All jazz, all like quote unquote heavy stuff. All of the small band stuff, Blakey, Wayne Shorter, Mingus. He was a sax guy, so he liked all alto and tenor players, you know what I mean?
And this love for jazz music was something he wanted to pass down to his son.
My pop got me a saxophone in the fifth grade. He got me an alto sax. We was in Philly at the time, and I started taking lessons with this dude named Bobby Zankel.
The world of music had opened up to him, and he was committed.
Played it that summer, came back with my mom, and continued to play sax in the jazz band and the concert band for the next 3 years.
And if you were to look close enough, you would see that he wasn't just trying to learn, he was trying to master.
Like, I would practice whatever we had to do on the practice sheet and then put on some record and try to get jiggy with the record or figure out what they were playing.
One of my favorite things about jazz music is improvisation. But any seasoned jazz musician will tell you, you have to know the record in order to improvise. And this was something that was drilled into young Ishmael early.
I stress preparation because when you're prepared, you know, that's the time you can play. Inventing as you're going, you know what I mean? Seeing 2-3 moves ahead, that kind of shit, you know? I've had that in me.
He also had an appreciation for lyrics. Not just the lyrics from the songs that his parents would listen to, but also from television.
If you had a good jingle on your thing that was catchy, I knew it and I was keen to it. I used to like Welcome Back Carter because it was always like the emotion of the lyrics, like Welcome Back. Your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back to the place that you always laughed about.
Well, the names have all changed since you hung around. But those dreams have remained and they've turned around.
Who'd have thought we need you? We tease him a lot because we got him on the spot. Welcome back, you know?
And as he was growing up, this appreciation for lyrics got a little deeper.
The first time I really heard hip-hop, it's a Last Poets song called E Pluribus Unum. It's by this guy named Jalil Nuruddin, who to me is the most influential lyricist rapper in my life. My dad was playing and we were riding in his car and I was just like, man, this is dope.
Selfish desires are burning like fires among those who hoard the gold as they continue to keep the people asleep and the truth from being told.
Racism and greed keep the people in need from getting what's rightfully theirs, lying and stealing and double dealing as they exploit the people's fears. To my dad and them, it was probably like the illest shit. You know, like, did you hear this? You know what I mean? Because that's how they bumped it.
This was 1972, still a long ways away from hip hop. So what he was hearing from the Last Poets was an attempt to articulate the struggle for black power in America. Needless to say, it left a mark. But this wasn't something he thought he could pursue. Instead, his passion was basketball.
Basketball is actually an equal obsession at music and actually took a hold of me way before music. I played basketball my whole life, went to one of the better basketball schools.
And this did a lot for his social life.
Basketball was my entree into popularity. My ability to play was notable and, like, you know how it is in communities, if people that can do things cool, they get a little bit of a reputation.
He was certainly developing his reputation as a basketball player. All of that exploration and hard work that was passed down to him, mixed with the preparation that only came with experience and discipline, definitely helped his skills on the basketball court. But those qualities were also helping him cultivate who he was gonna be as an MC. And luckily, he had a front row seat to early hip-hop in Seattle.
This group called the Emerald Street Boys. Sugar Bear, James Croon, like these were the cats older than me that was getting their name up in like dancing and rapping, and they had all the girls, and you know, they would perform down at the Seattle Center, and you know, like, and Sugar Bear, he was kind of like my cousin because his mom and my mom were tight. We would see each other at the cookouts and that kind of things. Our family knew each other. Knowing him was big because, you know, like, I would be at places he would be performing, just one of the kids in the crowd, and I knew him, you know what I'm saying?
He was fortunate enough to have a front row seat to hip-hop in Seattle and on the East Coast. Being so close to New York City with his dad, he got the music before most of his friends on the West Coast.
So it was two radio stations in New York. Chuck Chillout was on WBLS.
The power.
5 WBLS.
Red Alert was on Kiss FM.
We're chilling at 98.7 Kiss with our homeboy Cool DJ Red Alert.
On Saturday and Friday nights, they would have a hip-hop show. And that's when they used to have dual cassette, you know what I mean? So you would have two cassette things on. One would record and one would play so you could make duplicates. I can't even, like, explain to you the actual bombastic excitement that, like, cats tuned in all over. Like, so if you could get your hands on a Chuck Chillout or a Red Alert show, tape, wherever you got back to, you were the man. I mean, they just was playing songs that you wasn't gonna hear nowhere else and that weren't being played anywhere else, you know? I would get those tapes and bring them back.
Yo, we're the Boogie Down Production crew with the TR-808-D-Nice.
Man, and we would just sit around and listen to those tapes, man.
study the lines and study the bars.
And he was also studying hip-hop as a whole. It wasn't just the music he was bringing back to Seattle.
I would come back here, and I would have haberdashery, New York shit, you know what I'm saying? Lee jeans, flavored jeans, suede Pumas, a double goose down jacket with the fur collar, Terry Clark Kango hats, Kazal glasses, you know what I'm saying? Gold chains, shit like that. They would be like, yo, who is this dude? And my haircut was different, everything, you know what I'm saying? So that's how people kind of knew who I was, because I had this New York East Coast connection.
In no uncertain terms, Ishmael was that guy. He was already a stylish kid, going back and forth from Seattle to the East Coast with his dad, soaking up all the game he could, not just from his dad and his dad's cohorts, but also on the basketball court and in the sounds of hip-hop. He was on a journey of self-discovery that would lead him all the way to pursuing a career in music. Coming up, Ishmael goes from basketball star to rap star, and this journey will require him to use all of his skills that he picked up throughout his life to persevere. After the break, Ishmael becomes Butterfly and creates Diggable Planets. We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by Little Giants Giant Shorties. I've got a few kids living in my house, and I can tell you, their energy is something you can't suppress. When it comes to expressing themselves, you've got to let them shine. They are the culture, so why not let them dress like it? Shopping WeAreLittleGiants.com gives you access to plenty of options for styling your little shorty with the same authenticity you reserve for yourself. Find t-shirts, hoodies, shoes, onesies, and much more. Honestly, you'll be jealous they don't have your size. WeAreLittleGiants.com has designs that speak to the love we've had for hip-hop since we were kids ourselves. You'll be passing along your passion for the culture when you see your little giant rocking this Most Definitely t-shirt I'm about to cop for my son, or this Notorious RBG hoodie for my daughter. Slide through. Literally slide down the spiral slide and land in their flagship store ball pit at 4675 Hollywood Boulevard. Peace.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
It's the early 80s in Seattle, Washington, and young Ishmael Butler, soon to be known as Butterfly from Diggable Planets, is obsessed with basketball. And this obsession would keep him all over the city. And around the city, hip-hop was starting to gain some traction.
We used to go up to this thing called the Boys Club. The Boys Club had a gym in it and was like kind of a rec center. So, you know, everybody would go there after school till their mom got off work, shit like that.
And being a kid obsessed with playing basketball whenever he could, you know he was in the building.
It was cool. It was rough up there, but...
But this was another place for him to explore his love for basketball and a place where he would discover more ways that he could indulge in hip-hop. Enter Sir Mix-a-Lot.
I like big butts and I cannot lie.
And he would DJ weekends at this boys club. And it was like known as the hood party. All the young thug dudes and stuff would go up there. He's a legit town legend.
And between Sir Mix-a-Lot and the Emerald Street Boys, he saw that hip hop was starting to make its way all around the country. But thanks to a song that we've literally never mentioned 1,000 times on this show.
Everybody was just writing raps, you know? So I was writing raps in school, at home, rapping over everything that I could find, like I was developing the desire to be a rapper. But at that time, man, it was like some Lord of the Rings shit. Like, you wasn't gonna make it in the rap game. Like, you had to go to New York. You had to get a demo done. Like, nobody had no fucking studio at home. You know what I'm saying? What are you even talking about? You had to find a studio, number one. Get into the studio, two. Pay for it, three. And then what? Like, then you just had a demo on a tape. Now what? Now you gotta find a record label. How you even gonna get in the door? What's gonna happen? And don't nobody wanna hear that shit. So, it, like I said, it was like winning the lottery, man.
And the most that anybody participating in hip hop at the time could wish for was respect from their peers.
It really wasn't about making it and who's famous and who's gonna, cause if you could prove that you could do it, you was gonna get a certain amount of notoriety and fame wherever you was at.
And the culture had a little bit higher standards at the time as well.
Cass would tell you, man, you need to quit. You know what I'm saying? This ain't for you, you know what I mean?
He was testing the waters with hip hop, hoping to impress the people around him. But at the time, his main obsession was still basketball.
Basketball was the biggest part of my life up until I was probably 20 years old. I went to University of Massachusetts and played for a basketball coach there named John Calipari.
There is John Calipari. He was the Atlantic 10 coach of the year last year. Led you.
And despite how much time he had spent obsessing over basketball, he ended up pursuing music as his primary passion.
I never had professional hoop dreams. I was a very good player. I knew my limitations because of my size and stuff like that, but collegiate level for me was like my goal. Music, that's what I switched over to right around 19, 20 years old.
And choosing this obsession also meant that he was choosing a whole new life for himself.
I had to bet it all.
And the first thing that he put on the line was school.
Left school. I went to New York. I didn't have no money. I didn't have no place to stay. But all I knew was I wanted to, you know what, I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to make it. I'll figure it out when I get there. It's naivety. Some might even call it stupidity, but you kind of had to have that blind faith in order to make it.
It might look to some like he was unprepared, but he had spent his entire life working hard and going after what he wanted. But that didn't mean that everybody understood, namely his parents.
You what? You know what I'm saying? Like, nah, bro, like you gotta, that's fine. But you need to, you know what I mean? Don't leave school. What the fuck are you doing? You know what I mean? Like, that's how they looked at it.
His grandparents and parents have fought so hard to create a better life for their children. And now Ishmael was willing to risk all of that for his dream.
They had sacrificed, you know, and they saw sacrifice, you know, for opportunity for myself and my peers. So for me to kind of like throw it away, they didn't think that was respectful. And I didn't either, so I kept going at school kind of as long as I could.
But once he got to New York, it was a completely different story. As soon as he touched down, it was off to the races. And luckily, he had some family he could stay with until he was on his feet.
Well, I had a cousin there, you know, so I got the couch surf.
But that didn't mean it was comfortable.
They were like, every day, like, hey, when are you getting the fuck out of here? You know what I'm saying?
And with the clock ticking for him to get out and do his own thing, he had to resort to any methods he could in order to find his way into the music industry.
Back then, they used to have these trade magazines, Hits Magazine and shit like that. And they would sell them at like Tower Records, and it was for radio shit. And in the back of them, they would have, you know, independent record labels and their addresses and their lead A&R person and shit like that. So I copped one of those.
And he looked for any opportunity he could, and this paid off.
So I ended up getting a job working as an intern for Sleeping Bag Records.
Sleeping Bag Records was home to acts like Tila Rock. Nice and smooth. Sometimes I rhyme slower, sometimes I rhyme quick. I'm sweeter and thicker than a Chico stick. EPMD.
The employers of a year, yeah, we're back to work. I took time off. All the rappers got dripped.
And Just Ice.
To the best of my knowledge, I guess that I'm fresh on what I manifest. I never
pretend. Hold it, what's going on, John?
And this was just the entry-level position he needed to get his feet wet in the music industry.
What I was an intern and a runner. Back then, they used to make white labels, and these were test pressings of songs that were about to be released. They would give them to me as the intern, and I would have to take them to club DJs. I would go to the club, and we stand by the DJ booth, and, oh, yo, I got the new, you know what I'm saying? All young dudes and shit like that. But because of that, I got to kick it in all of the clubs and shit like that.
And he also got to rub shoulders with the artists.
You know, let's say, oh, bring a sleeping bag jacket to the guys. They're about to perform down at X Club. And then, okay, boom, I jump on the train and go down and they, oh, Ish, oh, yeah, he's here. He got the jacket.
He was constantly mixing with DJs and artists. And for him, this would have been a dream job. But it didn't really pay the bill. So he ended up doing what any young man in New York City in the 80s would do if he had connections.
Just hustling, man. You know what I mean? New York, you could get into a lot of things, some legal, some not, you know, but small time shit, never robbing nobody and no shit like that. Just like selling weed for the big bro or something like that. Just enough to pay my rent, which was probably like $75 or something like that, you know?
And he would need the money to pursue his passion. He wanted to be a recording artist. And in order to do that, he needed a demo. And in order to record a demo, he needed a studio. And that's where interning for Sleeping Bag came in handy.
There at that job, I met a dude who lived in Queens. He had a home studio. His name was Stacy. And he let me pay him to come out and record my demo.
But just because he found a spot didn't mean that it was gonna be easy.
He was like a cool-ass white boy from Florida, right? And he had this girlfriend. And she did not care for me coming over there, man. You know what I mean? How long are you gonna be here? How much money are you paying? Why? When are you, you know? And I was just like, yo, Stace, I'll give you the money next time I come. And if you don't bring the money, don't come next time. Like, she was out of control, man.
But when it came to actually getting down to business, he wasn't just recording. He was also learning how to make the tracks. There were many different machines that you could use to sample. On this show, you've heard us talk about producers using a drum machine called the SP-1200. But over at Stacy's house,
he had an MPC.
The Akai MPC would become a staple in hip-hop production.
That was where that was the way you could capture samples, edit, truncate, loop, add the beat to it, and get to rapping, you know what I'm saying? So that dude taught me all of that.
He was going over to Stacy's in an attempt to make as many records as he could. His plan was to get this demo recorded and shop it around the record labels. But he wasn't going out there as just Ishmael. He had already thought through how he wanted to present the music.
The original name was Swift Tactics, but then I changed it to Diggable Planets pretty early on, but it was just me. At the time, I'm listening to a lot of Sun Ra and a lot of, really, really a lot of P-Funk. And he was always on that, you know, interplanetary, outer space shit, you know, Clinton always talking about, you know, Star Child and citizens of the universe and all that kind of stuff. So I was thinking every person in themselves is kind of like a planet. We all, you know, sort of in orbit together, you know, and boom, boom, boom. That was kind of like where all that stuff came from. So a diggable planet, you know, a person that's diggable out here in this cosmos.
He was doing all of this world building and creating on his own, even before he had group members. And it would have been easy for him to just go ahead and do the solo thing.
But I always envisioned having a group, you know what I mean? Because back then, you was cool in a group. It wasn't individual shit popping off really like that, you know?
And his intuition would eventually pay off. As the only member of the Diggable Planets, it would take years before he was able to put himself where he wanted to be. And all of that exploration and determination from his upbringing would come in handy. He was about to pull off what nobody in Seattle Central District could have dreamed of. World tours, music videos, a gold record, and a Grammy Award. But first, he was gonna have to find some group mates. When we come back, he does just that. And the whole world gets a taste of Diggable Planets. Stay tuned.
Hip-hop in the 90s. It was incredible. It was groundbreaking. And let's be honest here, sometimes it was weird. Gold Rush is Stupidfly Media's latest hip-hop podcast. Each week, your host, Sean Kantrowitz, that's me, will be uncovering a different topic from the golden era of hip-hop. Some of it will hold a special place in your heart. Some of it will be a subject you may have forgotten about. And some of it, well, some of it we're still looking back and wondering, how the hell did this happen? And we won't be going on this journey alone. Each episode features in-depth, brand new interviews with the artists, producers, eyewitnesses, and key behind-the-scenes players of the golden era, including Grand Poobah, Del the Funky Homo Sapien, DJ Evil D, Fatlip from the Far Side, Hank Shockley of the Bomb Squad, Young MC, David Faustino, Merce, and many more. We all have great memories about 90s hip-hop, but you've never heard a podcast that looks back at it like this. Gold Rush, coming February 7th. Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe and follow at Stupidfly Media and at Hip Hop Gold Rush for more updates and exclusive content. It's the Gold
Rush. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome back. By this point in his journey, Ishmael had turned into Butterfly. He gave up his studies at the University of Massachusetts to pursue a career in music. This led him to New York City, working for Sleeping Bag Records as an intern. This was his foot in the door and also his gateway into recording a demo.
And when I got the demo done, I looked in the back of Hits magazine, found out all the addresses. They were all in Manhattan, like in these kind of like old office buildings. And you would go up, get on the elevator, go up to whatever the suite was or whatever, and knock on the door, and they would buzz you in. And it would be like this kind of like warehouse operation of independent record stuff, and see if you could leave your demo, or maybe you could see the A&R guy, and whoop, whoop, whoop. So I did that for like 2 years.
This was still in the early days of commercial hip hop. So if you wanted a record deal as an MC, you could mostly get in contact with the record labels. Back then, there were so many independent labels around New York that he could literally pick up a book and find the address. He had a go-getter attitude about the whole thing. But keep in mind, he was from Seattle, and he was making it up as he went along. There was really no rule book for getting on in hip-hop in the 80s, and it was easy for doubt to creep in, especially when you're in the mecca of hip-hop, New York City, around New York City artists.
They're definitely on a pedestal. I'm coming from Seattle. I'm seeing, you know, these real New York hip-hop gods, you know what I mean? But at the same time, you know, whether you realize it or not, it eventually sinks in that you're standing right there with them, you know? The only difference is the sort of proximity to this goal. It starts sinking in, like, if I'm here, maybe I'm here. I think that's sort of dawning on me after a while.
And that confidence would definitely help, as he needed to recruit members.
I used to run with this dude named Squid from here.
Here in Seattle.
He came to the East Coast to visit. I'm like, yo, we be in this group with me. All right, cool, cool. The first demo had a picture of me and him on it. So there was another ladybug, too, this other sister named Katrina Lust that I went to UMass with. She lived in New York. She was going to be Ladybug. But it took so long to get the deal and stuff that life just swerved in and they had to do other shit.
And it's crazy that he already had the names and everything picked out for Diggable Planets.
Man, I had this whole world, like, notebooked out, man. I probably had 15 insect names for different people that might be involved. Like, yeah, it was all mapped out.
And even though the original two members didn't last,
we actually got in Rolling Stone magazine in that incarnation of Diggable Planets, in the Rolling Stone with Pee Wee Herman on the cover.
And eventually, the planets would align for him to meet just the right people at the right time.
Cats would be in New York, just be like, yo, let's go down to Howard and go have fun, kick it. And I used to see this guy everywhere, Philly, D.C., New York, Baltimore. Who is this dude? Cino, he was like a party promoter. He was in a rap group himself. He used to dress hella fly, had a big flat top like cats used to wear back then, so.
This was Doodlebug.
When I started seeing him, I was like, yo, I think I want him to be in the group. You know what I'm saying?
So one day, he's down in Philadelphia.
And they got this place called The Gallery. The Gallery's where all the neighborhoods come downtown and hang out. It's like a mall, shopping mall, sneaker stores, all that shit. And I seen him and his man, Jamar, coming down the escalator. At the bottom of the escalator was like a magazine store. And the magazine had just come out with the Pee Wee Herman cover and the Rolling Stones. So I was like, yo, come here for a sec. Let me show you something, man. I said, listen, man, I got this group, man. You know, check it out. I'm in Rolling Stone, boom, boom, boom. I want you to, you know, be down and shit like that. He was like, yeah, okay, okay. And you could tell, like, the fact that it was in Rolling Stone, he was like, okay, you know. We started hanging out, writing rhymes and talking about it and dreaming and all that kind of stuff. And then he knew Mecca.
That's Ladybug Mecca.
She was from Maryland. He met her in D.C. but they were up in Philly at the time, and we used to just start all hanging out, dreaming and shit like that.
And even after solidifying group members, it was still a grind to get a record deal. But sooner than later, opportunity would meet preparation.
I was living in Jersey City, and I was coming to New York on the PATH train every day. I met this lady on the PATH train. I gave her my demo tape. She gave it to her friend, this dude named Dennis Wheeler. He was working at Pendulum. He dug it, and that got the ball rolling.
Pendulum Records was a hip-hop label that was founded by Ruben Rodriguez, and they were being distributed by the powerhouse label Elektra Records. And the plan was for them to release an album for Butterfly that had been in the works for years. And that was years and years of thought and preparation.
Because it was just my dream, you know what I mean? I had been spent every minute of the day for the last fucking 10 years on this shit, you know what I mean?
Like, and all of that preparation allowed him to create a sound with these two new members, Doodlebug and Ladybug Mecca, a sound that was unique to them, and also had Butterfly talking about some topics that many rappers weren't touching at the time. He took inspiration from The Last Poets and decided to speak to issues that were happening around him. I'm talking about a song on the album about abortion called La Femme Fatale.
Spontaneity has brought a third, but due to our youth and economic state, we wish to terminate. About this we don't feel great, but baby, that's how it is. But the feds have dissed me, they ignored and dismissed me. The pro-lifers harassed me outside the clinic and called me a murderer. Now that's hate.
At that age, I knew some people that were going through that. It resonated with me. I understood those that were against it, the oppression that was inherent in it, and I didn't like it.
So he felt he had a responsibility to speak up, a responsibility that came from his home.
My parents were always political. They saw life, existence through politics, a political lens, in that they always sided with the oppressed, partly because that's where they had been sort of relegated to because of the color of their skin and the opportunities that were not being given to them, you feel me? So as a kid, I understood that it was a responsibility to know what's going on and speak about it, do something about it, never let injustice go by without addressing it or doing something to push it out. So I thought that's what you were supposed to do.
And as the quarterback of this whole Diggable Planet situation, he was also supposed to make really good records. Songs that would get stuck in the listener's mind. Songs like Where I'm From.
Boogie jobbing rap is life where I'm from. Where I'm from, Ahmad play where Izzy where I'm from. Where I'm from, it be like run your coat black. Jupiter keeps a fat beats by the pack. Where I'm from, nappy hair is life. We be reading Marx where I'm from. The kids be rocking clocks where I'm from. You turn around your cap, you talk over a beat, and dig some sounds booming out of Jeep where I'm from.
They were making groovy, jazz-infused hip-hop, and it was a breath of fresh air. When you listen to it, you can tell that this was a very high-concept project, a project that would only come together like this with preparation.
I was focused, but it was the focus of preparation, you know? I had seen it. It was my idea. I was gonna see it through according to specs.
And after years of cutting demos on his own and needing to rebuild the group with two new group members, he was now with two MCs that he really trusted. And that was evident in how things played out with their biggest hit, Rebirth of Slick.
Knowledge had this other group.
That's Doodlebug. They also call him Knowledge.
When his boys back in Philly and they had a song called No Bus Fear, had elements of that loop.
He's referring to the bass line to a song called Stretching by Art Blakey. He heard the track that the other producer made, and at first it was just a song that he really liked, but he was forced to remember it when he was backed into a corner over their initial single.
So we had this song called Brown Baby's Funk, which everybody at the label, everybody that ever heard it was like, yo, that's y'all's single. But it had a George Duke sample in it, and he wouldn't clear it. So we was like, yo, we gotta get another single, you know, something. So I had always liked that song. I said, yo, man, my man Bun had made that song. I said, Bun, what record was that?
Butterfly got the record and got to work.
And so we had to kind of go in and last minute. And they were like, you got something? I said, yeah, I got something. So boom, we go in.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lips. Them, they got boo bodies, hard rock Brooklyn kids. Us floor rush when the DJ booming classics.
And come up with the cool like that thing.
But I'm cool like that. 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 I'm cool.
Delivered it, you know, and I just remember everybody kind of being, I know they were wary because we had got all the way up to the single and it fell through, you know what I'm saying? Like, fucking, it was tragedy, really. So when they heard this new joint, it was better than the one we had. Cause the cool like that, the piece like that, the slick like that, the horn, you could tell that they thought it was had a chance, you know what I'm saying? Because it had hooks and stuff, you feel me?
They had delivered a home run, and they were about to see the fruits of all of their labor. Rebirth of Slick was about to open up all the doors. Doors that would take them all around the globe, on television, onto the Grammy stage, and into the hip-hop history books. We'll be right back after this.
This is Son Dobe from Funk Dobias. Thanks for tuning in to Fresh Era. Did you know that these guys over at Stupid Fly are doing this strictly out of the love for 90s hip-hop culture? If you like what you hear, please do me a favor. Go to stupid-fly.com and pick up some merch to show your support. Then follow them on Instagram and Facebook at Stupid Fly Media. Thank you for supporting our community of Golden Era Gladiator. Now head over to stupid-fly.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
It's the fall of 1992, and Diggable Planets is getting ready for the release of their debut single, Rebirth of Slick.
We finished that, and that's the single. We got a gig in London right as the single was coming out. We go to London, play at this club, do our thing, and the single picking up steam. They're like, yo, we're gonna do a video. My mom flew out for the video. That's her hand snapping in the video. She's in there a couple times too. And the video comes out and starts moving up on the video charts, like on BET. Every week they would have the top 10 video pull like that, bumping. You know what I'm saying? All the way went up to number one.
Everybody in the country was down with Diggable Planets.
It was real, you know what I'm saying? Like, damn, like, we did it.
Yo, what's up? We are proud to debut a new rap group, kicking off their single, Rebirth of Slick.
Please welcome Pendulum recording artist, Diggable Planets.
My sisters and my brothers, but that's how I'm living when I'm living on living color, and I'm cool like that. 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 I'm cool.
Check it out.
In February of 1993, Diggable Planets' debut album, Reachin', a new refutation of time and space, was released on Pendulum Elektra Records. And off the strength of their monster debut single, they hit the U.S. Billboard Top 200. And they peaked at number 5 on the U.S. Top R&B Hip-Hop Albums chart. From there, it was straight to the moon. And on their way, they were stopping in cities all around the world.
Well, yeah, because we were able to headline like 1,000-seat venues at the time. You know what I mean? So it would be somebody opening for us.
And at a certain point, they got the opportunity to tour with Sade.
You know, that was the first time I've been around a really, 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 really big star, you know, like in the backstage area and all that. And I remember she used to have this like ex-MI6 type dude named Alf that was her like main security guard. You could tell, you know what I mean? Don't play around. But before she would go on stage, they would, like, wherever you were, you had to stop and stay there until she got from her dressing room to the stage. And I remember one time somebody in our band was just like, she's way over there, man, she ain't. And that dude, Alf, man, ran up on him, man. And from then on, everybody stayed still, man. But
and when they weren't on tour, they were able to participate in things like MTV's Daytona Beach Jams.
I'm interplanetary. My insect room is every. It's busy if it's here. Deep where I'm from.
We will be cool like that with Daytona Beach Jams continues.
And it was wild. Like, it's countdowns and camera movements and this and that. Okay, now, okay, you're on. You know what I'm saying? You do your thing and then, okay, now get up out of here. We got something else going. You know what I mean? Like,
1993 was a crazy year for Diggable Planet. They were everywhere from MTV to In Living Color to David Letterman. And this was a big deal for a hip-hop act because the Late Night Show with David Letterman featured legendary musician Paul Schaefer.
At that time, you find out Paul's band's playing the music. Because we had a band, you know what I mean? But they're like, nah, Paul's band's playing the music. And I remember thinking like, oh man, these corny ass dudes ain't gonna be able to, you know what I'm saying? We had a band and they're all like Berkeley cats, like music jazz heads, you know what I mean? Cool dudes. So we had to tell them, you guys ain't playing on this show. We going to Paul Schaefer band. And I thought they were gonna be like, ah, oh, that shit's gonna be milk toast. But I remember them all being like, oh, shit, you're going to see Schaefer. Because to the musicians that knew, they respected him because these motherfuckers could play anything. Oh, he could do an arrangement and your shit was going to sound just like your record sounded. You know what I mean?
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the program Diggable Planets. Kid!
Boogie job and rap is life where I'm from. Where I'm from, I'm my play. Where is he? Where I'm from, where I'm from.
I realized, like, don't be, you know, judging books by the cover and shit like that. Motherfuckers are bad, man. You just, you know?
And as 1993 came to a close, they got word that they were nominated for a Grammy. And Butterfly took this opportunity to bring his parents along with him.
They probably hadn't seen each other in probably 5 years, 6 years. Frank Sinatra was there that night. And I remember we were sitting, like, in the chairs and shit. And Aretha Franklin was, like, on the next aisle over there. And you know, my mom was kind of like fidgeting and stuff like that. And I was like, what's going on? She was like, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. And later on, she told me, she was just like, you know, like Aretha Franklin, you know, like, and then I had to think like, oh, wow. Like, to her, that must be like seeing the queen. You know what I mean? Like, literally, it is that. You know what I mean?
And right there in front of the chairman of the board and the queen, Diggable Planets category is announced.
And the Grammy goes to, all right now, Diggable Planet and Bertha Slick.
I'd like to first thank my mom and dad over there.
We also opened up for James Brown in Brazil for 3 shows.
And he was able to bring his mother along with him.
You know, James Brown, he's like this, like, country dude, but he's very proverbial in the way that he looks at life and shit.
So when he got an opportunity to talk to the Godfather of Soul, he didn't know what to expect. He had shaken hands with him backstage at a show, but now they were on their way back to the States.
We were getting on the plane. We're sitting down and James Brown's seat is right over there. And I'm like, man, there go James Brown. She said, go over there and tell him thank you for, you know, letting y'all boom. So I go over there and I'm like, Mr. Brown, we opened up for you. I just want to say thanks for the opportunity. Me and my mom, we really, you know, enjoyed it. And he said, well, stay in school. I go sit back to my mom. I'm like, I'm thinking he hit me with this, like, this cliche thing, like, boom, boom, boom. She looked at me like, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, and I realized then, like, yeah, if James Brown tells you something, you got to unpack that shit, really. Which my mom was able to do like that, you know what I mean? I was like, oh, okay, I will. I will stay learning.
So at this point, it's 1994, and their single Rebirth of Slick has already gone gold, selling over 500,000 copies. And while they've been out working the record, they've also been recording their sophomore album, Blowout Cone. On the first album, they worked with producers Shane Faber and Mike Mangini. But on the second album, they went with Dave Darlington, who would craft a different sound for this second album. And with this shift in sound came a shift in content.
We wanted to come a little harder, get more political, let people know where we was really coming from, what we thought and what we believed. C's parents is revolutionaries too. Mech was really feeling the force of all of that stuff too. So we were pretty solid at that time on where we wanted to come from with that.
I'm slicker this year, I'm slicker this year. Myrtle Ave, A-Train, got the pick in my head. And what, 16 joints later still lounge. Fresh, from Flatbush in my baggy booster vest. Style is tight, beats, busted Tammy fatigues. 50,000 leagues of black, so we're chef. Can we avenue slide, player style, get a walk to the east, sun. Wow, Crookland, New York.
Blowout Comb was released in the fall of 1994, and critically, it was a massive success. Publications went in on how amazing the lyrics and the music was. But for a number of reasons, including Pendulum switching from Elektra Records to EMI, this album didn't do nearly as well as their debut. And as 94 turned into 95, it was time for everybody to go their separate ways.
I know Knowledge really, like I said, I sort of took him out of a world of his own that was, he was the impetus of, you know? And he kind of lended his energy to a thing where I was that. And I think after a little bit of that, he wanted to go and do his thing. You know what I mean? That's why it was amicable, really, you know? And Mac, you know, the same. So it really wasn't bad or like nasty. Yeah, I look at it like we did manage to stay together for those years, make two albums. Blowout Comb's arguably more loved in the end than Reaching is. But we just been lucky to have a long longevity with the music, you know?
This year marks the 30th anniversary of their debut album, Reaching. And what's really dope is that Butterfly, Ladybug, and Doodlebug are all touring right now. Fresh Era is a Stupid Fly production, written and edited by me, Craig Smith, and executive produced by DJ Cheap Shot. Chris Barnett, Stay in School. Sean Berman is our mix engineer. Music by The Math Club. Artwork by Ray Allen David. As always, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can follow us on Instagram at Fresh Era Podcast. Follow me at I Am Craig Smith. Go to stupid-fly.com to sign up for our newsletter and to purchase merchandise. And go subscribe to our new show, Gold Rush. We'll see you on the next episode of Fresh Era.